you say. Go ahead. Yeah, you're lucky you didn't time it out because you didn't wait for the beeps. Dennis, first of all, your squalos. These antennas, I know that there's a square loop antenna that was built by the guy in California. I can't think of his call letters right now. Is the plane of the square loop antenna parallel to the earth? First, tell me that. Are you going to be mounting the square loop antenna so that the loop itself is parallel to the surface of the earth? That's the first question. Over to you, Dennis, on that one. Wait for the beeps.
Yes, Dick, and they'll be in an H configuration.
Okay. Now, the H configuration, does that mean you're going to put up a total of four of them, two wide and two high? Is that what you're saying by the H configuration? All parallel to the earth, two wide, two high. Over to you, Dennis.
Correct. And I've spoken to the manufacturer who happens to be a ham that you might be interested in taking a look at QRZ. It's N0URW. He doesn't work AME, but boy, he's got some antennas. Anyway, yes, go ahead, Dick.
Okay, each square loop antenna is a horizontally polarized, nearly omnidirectional. It's got a little bit of a front-to-back ratio, so to speak, but it's a nearly omnidirectional antenna. And you mount four of them. Let's go step by step. If you mounted two of them, one above the other, that's half of the H, one exactly above the other, you would have a much narrower elevation beamwidth, but you would have the exact same azimuth beamwidth when you did that. In other words, your azimuth pattern, you would think nothing would happen. And if you got a reasonable spacing between the two, you would be getting close to 3 dB of extra gain by vertical stacking a pair of them. In other words, it would be one pancake on top of the other. And by the way, these square loop antennas, are you doing this on 2 meters or 440? Over to you on that one, Dennis. Go ahead.
Yes, it's 2 meters, and they are pancakes, and they're stacked about 72 inches, and I am seeing definite gain over a single. Go ahead.
You got to be very careful with the way you feed them also. In other words, from the power divider that feeds the two antennas, you got to make sure they got the exact same cable length between the two, and the two antennas tune the same. If one antenna is tuned high and one antenna is tuned low in frequency, you would be skewing the pattern. So I think you're saying you have mounted two of them vertically right now, and you're thinking of mounting two more horizontally displaced. Is that what you're considering, Dennis? Go ahead.
Yes, I have two mounted vertically now. I have two mounted on ground, and I've hooked the harnesses, the phasing harnesses up, and I've got them all tuned properly. I'm just wondering what I should expect. Go ahead.
It turns out that every antenna has a beamwidth in the direction that you're considering as a function of what is the width of the antenna in that direction. In other words, if I mount two antennas, one above the other, because of my vertical stacking, my total effective area has gotten taller vertically. That means my vertical beamwidth is going to go to a much smaller number. But because your vertical beamwidth is aimed at the horizon, the fact that your vertical beamwidth has gotten smaller on that horizon, you don't feel the difference, except for when an airplane flies over your house and you're measuring the antenna pattern. But for almost all the guys you're going to talk to on 6 meters, they're on the horizon. Therefore, you don't see the vertical beamwidth when you've done vertical stacking. Let me drop. When you do horizontal stacking, for the first time now, you're going to be building a horizontal pattern broadside to the two vertical stacks. In other words, if I've got two vertical stacks, one east of my mast and one west of my mast, two vertical stacks, I will be favoring a signal coming from the north and coming from the south, broadside to the stack. That's what I'll be favoring. But some number of degrees off of north, you're going to get a null in the pattern, because what's really going on is that picture A signal coming in from, let me say, the northeast. The signal coming from the northeast is going to hit the eastern stack sooner than the western stack. Therefore, there's a phase shift between the two. At some particular physical angle from north in my stacking arrangement that I just described, at some physical angle, you're going to get 180 degrees of shift in the phase because of the signal arriving one versus the other. Therefore, there's going to be a null in the pattern in that direction. So your omnidirectional pattern, you're going to lose the omnidirectional pattern when you use horizontal stacking. Let me drop. And that's going to be a pain in the neck if you don't have a rotator on this whole H-plane effect. You haven't mentioned, but do you intend to use a rotator? If not, this nulling of the pattern is going to give you a bit of a pain. So are you considering using a rotator on the lazy H that you're describing? Over to you, Dennis, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, it is 2 meters, by the way. No, I'm not. I have a four-element quad up there. I am in a cold era in Cold Spring here. I'm basically in the mouth of a volcano, and the quad way better transmitting, but the reception is terrible because I'm bouncing or receiving signals off reflections of the iron mounds around me. Anyway, I'm not going to be rotating it. So what you're saying, let me let it drop here. So my maximum gain is going to be not left and right of the side-by-side pairs, but in the opposite direction. Is that correct? Go ahead.
That's correct. Your maximum gain is going to be broadside to the array. If you've got your stack such that the mast is in the center of the tower, and you've got two vertical stacks to the east of the tower, two vertical stacks to the west of the tower, east and west is your displacement, you're going to favor broadside. Your signal will be strongest to the north and strongest to the south, broadside of the array. And some number of degrees off of north, and that's calculatable, you're going to get a null in the pattern. So if this is the best of all worlds, I know it's going to be physically difficult, but if you could purely vertically stack the antennas, you'd be way ahead of the game. And the pure vertical stacking, you've got a little bit of leeway on that. In other words, if two of them are on the mast above the tower, and two of them are on the side of the tower, just a little bit displaced from the tower, but pure vertical stacking would avoid an awful lot of this crazy antenna pattern you're going to get. I wonder if that's possible. Over to you, Dennis. K2LIW, wait for the beeps.
K2RAW, yes, that makes full sense to me now. And that's what the manufacturer said. Daniel, yeah, he said stack four of them. The problem is I've got to stack them about, stacking height would be about 15 feet and I only have 10 feet in the condo. So, okay. I have to revisit this a bit, but thank you so much. You've helped so much, and this network is wonderful. Back to you, Dick. K2RAW, K2LEG.
And let me do a quick vertical, quick mental statement here. You're stacking them, the recommendation is 72 inches apart, 6 feet. Let's see, a wavelength on 6 meters is 18 feet, roughly. Yeah. In the vicinity of 18 feet. Half wave is 9 feet. You're 6 feet of stacking. Huh. Yeah, I'm not recommending you go very much closer in stacking distance. If the individual patterns overlap, you don't pick up all of the advantage. There's nothing magic about the number that you vertically stack being an even number. If you don't have as much vertical real estate to put four of them vertically stacked and you only vertically stack three of them, it's a little bit more difficult to make a 3-to-1 power divider. But vertically stacking three of them would give you 4.5 dB of gain as opposed to one of them, 4.7 I think is the number. you're getting close to 3 dB of gain with two of them stacked. 3 of them stacked is going to give you something like 4.5 dB of gain. 4 of them stacked could give you as much as 6. But you don't have the real estate for 6. So maybe for the time being, before you make some kind of a mechanical change where you can stack 4 of them, stacking 3 is a possibility. Give that some thought, Dennis. Over to you, Dennis, K2RAW.
K2RAW, K2LAG. Yes, Dick, but it's 2 and 70 inches is my stacking distance. So, okay, stacking 3 of them, the phasing harness might be a little bit tricky. Anyway, how about stacking 4 on 2 meters? Well, what would be a good stacking distance? I have about 12 feet of stacking distance. Go ahead.
The proper stacking distance, Dennis, is a function of what is the capture area of each antenna. If you were standing out in space and if your eyes operated at 6 meters and you looked into that antenna, you would see a great big large black dot in space for each individual antenna. And your stacking distance is chosen so that those two black dots do a little bit more than kiss each other, a little bit of overlap. So the stacking distance is a function of the kind of antenna, not the number that you're stacking. So each antenna has got a certain area to it, and you don't want those areas to overlap. That's what chooses your stacking distance. Does that make some sense, Dennis? K2LEG, K2RAW.
Yes, kind of. Go ahead.
So if 72 inches is the right stacking distance, the fact that you're stacking 2, 3, or 4 doesn't change that stacking distance antenna to antenna. Move them too close together, the areas overlap, and you don't get the gain increase. Stacking them too far apart gives you some other problems, nowhere near as difficult. So you don't have enough real estate for all 4. What's stopping you from constructing a taller mast with guy wires? Don't worry about the guy wires that hold your mast up vertically. It's not going to interfere with the antenna pattern. Your antenna is horizontally polarized. Those guy wires that hold it vertical are at cross angle to it. They'll have no effect. So with guy wires, could you have a taller mast that allows you to mount all 4 of them vertically stacked? Over to you, Dennis, K2RAW.
K2RAW, K2LEG. Well, my problem is, once again, I'm in, and this is up in an attic, Dick. And I only have about 12 feet of space that I can work with. It's a gigantic attic, or I have 2 actually. And the quality works out pretty well in transmit, but receive, because of where I am, it's terrible. Anyway, back to you. Go ahead.
Okay. If you have access to the roof, you could stack 2 of them inside the attic and 2 more of them above the attic. You could put a mast above the roof, vertically right above the ones that are inside the attic. There's nothing magic about having all of them inside the house. Over to you, Dennis.
What I failed to mention is I'm in an HOA-controlled and a very strict-controlled condo and no outside antennas. So we'll see if the Amateur Radio Parity Act is going to help. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah, if you've absolutely positively got to keep them inside the attic, so that the HOA, so the Homeowners Association doesn't give you grief, and you've only got 12 feet to work with, and you can stack a total of 3 of them, I guess. So, and you don't have the real estate to stack 4. To stack them closer together wouldn't gain you anything. The fourth antenna, if you add a fourth antenna and change the stacking distance of all of them, you're not going to pick up any significant improvement. So sounds to me like you've only got enough real estate to stack 3 of them. Is that true? If I got the picture correct, Dennis, over to you, K2RAW. Wait for the beeps.
I've only got 12 feet, and 3 would be the max. And as you said, if spacing them closer wouldn't gain me anything. In the side-by-side H configuration, it would give me a real funky field pattern. So anyway, I've learned a lot tonight, Dick. Go ahead.
Stacking them horizontally with the H pattern wouldn't be so bad if you had a rotator. Is there enough room in that attic that you could use a rotator on that H pattern? Go ahead.
That's a thought. I've got many rotators from the old days. I've got a pair of 13-2s that I love to put up, but the HOA won't let me do it. Go ahead.
Okay, some of your words are dropping out, and so I'm missing some of the story. I think you're saying you could use a rotator and that you used to use a rotator. So is there enough real estate inside that attic that the four of them stacked horizontally 6 feet and vertically 6 feet, could you squeeze that all inside and rotate it? And by the way, because there's no wind loading, you could use a pretty low duty factor rotator, if you know what I mean, as long as you make things mechanically balanced. Over to you, Dennis, K2LAW, wait for the beeps.
K2RW, K2LEG. Yes, okay, that's something I have to look at, see if I have enough horizontal swing room to rotate them. Good point. Okay, thank you so much, Dick. K2RW, K2LEG.
And when I get a chance, I think I'll be able to calculate what that horizontal pattern will look like for your H. But some number of mechanical degrees is probably going to be 45 or 60 degrees away from north in that example I gave. You're going to get a null in the pattern. And then you're going to get a side lobe out to the east and to the west. So that pattern, once you know the stacking distance, is very predictable. It's a phased array kind of a thing. But any horizontal stacking is going to give you a horizontal pattern that's no longer omnidirectional. Therefore, you're going to want to use a rotator. Okay, let's go over to Roy, AC2GS, K2LIW. Go ahead with your science and physics report, Roy, which is going to be number 31, I think. You got it, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, everyone. Again, if you need to give me any questions or any topics or any suggestions of what you want discussed, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Once again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And a lot of the things that I'll be mentioning will have links. I'll mention the links, but if you don't write them down, you can go to a main page that has all the links listed, and you just click in your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and it'll take you to the link page. Let me drop.
And by the way, that beautiful thin air that you were given last week, when people go to that one, explaining lightning, that's a very well, nice, written and illustrated website. I'm sure you've looked at that one. It gives you a nice explanation of what's going on with lightning and why it acts the way it does. So that page of yours, roy.ac2gs.com, has got some nice information on it, Roy. Very well done. Over to you, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. Well, I only look at the best web pages on the subject that I can find. There's a lot of web pages out there. Some are better than others, and I try to come up with the best of the options and offer it to people. And I hope they check out that page and click a few of those links, because I think they'll enjoy it. I think it's informative. Let me drop, and I'll get to topic one. Okay, recently in the news is something called an M-drive. Now, we've talked about the M-drive in the past on the Tactical Net. It's a curious device that NASA is tinkering with. It doesn't really quite make any sense. It seems to defy the laws of physics, which is not a good thing. But it does generate some kind of a drive. So the design was kind of leaked to other scientists, and they've tried to reproduce the M-drive. a bunch of Germans tried to replicate it, and they gave a interesting report to a French conference, which I'll describe in a second. Let me drop. They built a replica of the M drive. They put it in a vacuum chamber. They put a force gauge in with it. They put a couple of watts of power, and surprise, surprise, they got about 4 micronewtons of force from the drive. So you think success. But they were smart, those German guys. They had designed it with a servo mechanism. It turned the drive in reverse, and they put another couple of watts in, and sure enough, they got a force of about 4 micronewtons again. So, gee, all things good with the M-drive. Then those clever guys pointed it at 90 degrees. Now, if you remember your good old days in high school physics, a force applied at a 90-degree angle shouldn't give you anything. But when they turned it on, surprise, surprise, they still got 4 micronewtons of force. Let me drop. So the point of the exercise is no matter where you point the drive, it seems to develop force in one direction, which is not what drives do. If you take a rocket engine and you turn it upside down, it's not going to go in the same place. So what they've thought of as the most likely candidate for why this is happening is they believe that it's a aspect of something called Lorentz force in the power conduit. They couldn't shield all the power lines. So the power lines feeding into the M drive interact with Earth's magnetic field, producing these micronewtons of force, which sort of means that you have to carry the Earth with you if you want to use this type of design, which is really not feasible. They also tested something called a Mach effect device, which is a very weird, that's apparently an asymmetric oscillator. And they did the same tricks with that, and they found that that doesn't give you any drive that makes any sense. So a lot of these dubious drives that don't make any sense shouldn't make any sense, because it's the Lorentz forces and the Earth's magnetic field that's giving them the force that they're detecting. Let me drop. Now, this isn't the last word. Nothing is ever the last word. It's not an exact copy of the M drive. I think they ran it at half the power that the original NASA design called for. So they're going to modify it to run at full power. But chances are that the M drive and the Mach effect drives are going to go down in history as pathological science, along with polywater and N-rays. M drive, may it rest in peace.
I wonder if you've ever explained what the M drive is. It really is a... It looks like a feed horn for a microwave antenna, except there is a chunk of metal across the open mouth of the horn, so that it develops a very strong resonant field inside of this horn-shaped structure, and they wanted to believe they could get some electronic thrust out of that. And when I first saw that, I was very skeptical, because there is no way that any material could come squirting out of that. To get thrust in space, you have to be accelerating something. A bullet being accelerated because you fired the gun in space will give you thrust. Well, you get action and reaction. Bullets go out in one direction, and the gun goes in the other direction as a kickback, so to speak. And that's sort of the way a rocket works. Well, this thing doesn't squirt anything out, so therefore to explain the thrust was very spooky, like polywater. And so I think you're saying that it really was the magnetic field of the power leads feeding this thing, combined with the Earth's magnetic field, was giving them a force, and by changing the direction, they sort of figured out what's going on. AC2GS, K2RAW.
Yes, exactly, Dick. The M-drive, to me, I would describe it as a sealed cavity microwave generator. And as you mentioned, propulsion works on momentum. You know, momentum is conserved, so if you throw mass and velocity in one direction, your rocket ship goes off in the opposite direction to balance the momentum. But the M-drive didn't eject any momentum anyplace. So again, it sort of violated a bunch of laws of physics, and people had very, very interesting esoteric explanations that went into the deep underlings of quantum mechanics, but unfortunately, it was just a misinterpretation of results, like a lot of things tend to unfortunately become. And it's good that science works on these checks and balances and figures these things out. So you should never go with first reports or sometimes even second or third reports. You got to let science go through their process. But yeah, that's the M drive, and it was discussed a lot in the TechNet, probably before my time on the TechNet. But I recall many times it being brought up, especially as guys would come up with these interesting esoteric explanations of why it could defy the laws of physics.
I'm going to add a couple words to this. If I was using a six shooter to develop thrust in space, I fire the bullets. The bullets I'm firing to the north. The kickback on the gun gives me a force to the south, and I get some thrust to the south by firing bullets to the north. But eventually I run out of bullets. In the case of a rocket engine, you're squirting fuel that has some mass. After heating it in the combustion chamber, you're squirting it out as fast as you can at the nozzle, and you squirt that to the north, and you get some thrust to the south. But eventually you run out of fuel. This M-drive thing was a real dream. If that could have worked, it didn't need fuel. You just pumped electricity into it. And as long as you got a set of solar cells that can keep gathering the electricity from the sun, you could get thrust from this thing forever. Sounds great, but boy, is that a dream. So the nasty truth of getting real thrust in space is that you have to be throwing out something that has mass, and whatever it is, you eventually run out of it. The reason why ionic drive is so much more efficient is that with ionic drive, in theory, you can accelerate your particles a fraction of the speed of light. The velocity of the particles coming out of your rocket engine really is the efficiency, so to speak. And the efficiency is a number they call specific impulse. So if you could squirt the particles out of the engine at 0.999 the speed of light, boy, you'd get a lot of thrust per particle. But now, getting the particles up to that speed is a problem. Yeah, with the Large Hadron Collider, you can do it, but putting the Large Hadron Collider in space is a little bit difficult. So the nasty truth is that no matter what you do in space, you're eventually going to run out of the fuel that gives you the thrust, with everything we know about getting thrust right now. With some kind of an anti-gravity machine, yeah, there's a better way, but we're a long way from understanding what the hell gravity really is. That's my impression of gravity, and it sure would be nice to have an anti-gravity machine. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yes, it certainly would be nice to have an anti-gravity machine. It would be nice to have a perpetual motion machine. It would be nice to have a free energy machine. The closest that actually makes sense to me on a basis of physics would be something like a laser rocket, in which, because light does have a minuscule but a non-zero momentum, so you can drive the momentum of a light beam. It's not going to be terribly fast. It's not going to give you a heck of a lot of acceleration, but I could at least make a theoretical construct that it obeys the laws of physics.
In the case of your laser beam coming out of your thrusting engine, that's the one case where you seem to not have a tank that runs empty. As long as you've got a real good set of solar cells, as long as you're close enough to something like the sun where you can be collecting energy to run this thing. However, if you were out to where Voyager is right now, three times the distance to Pluto, the sun out there is so dim that no matter how massive your solar panels are, you're not going to get much electricity to run your laser pointer. So you're still going to run into a problem, as I see it, Roy. The laser pointer sounds very, very efficient. It's got a very high specific impulse, But boy, is that amount of thrust minuscule. It's micro, it's nano minuscule in the thrust that you get. How long would it take us if I ran a laser at 1 watt of laser power output? How much thrust do you think I could get out of that one, Roy? Over to you, K2IAW.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Just an interesting point with the EM drive. It was a TV show and came on last year, first year, and it's been renewed for a second season called Salvation. And the whole show was, you know, we've got to get off the Earth and maybe go to Mars, you know. But the whole show is based on this EM drive, how they finally successfully were able to get it to run. I don't know what they're going to do next year if this thing is proven wrong, but it has been renewed for a second season. It's called Salvation. It's actually a pretty good show. It's on CBS Channel 2. Back to you, Roy. WS2N.
Outside of some internet forums, I don't think people take science fiction seriously enough to put up arguments. But getting back to what Dick you asked, I wouldn't be surprised if it's a semi-ridiculous amount of force in the femto-newton.
And by the way, you can have a lot of fun with units. We all know what a milliwatt is, a microwatt, a nanowatt, a picowatt, a femtowatt. The next smaller than that is an attowatt. What happens if it's only an attonewton? And what's the next small unit smaller than atto? You probably know. I keep forgetting that one. I think you eventually get down to zepto and yocto, which I think is 10 to the 24, or minus 24. Oh, you, Eric. Here we go. Roy, K2RIW.
Yeah, some clever guy has figured it all the way down. I like to default to just exponentials, you know, 10 to the minus whatever. It saves me a lot of wear and tear on my memory. But there are names for all these little things. But, you know, watts of light have some momentum, but very, very little. And we sort of go back to our discussions about true radiometers and true solar sails and those that work on the basis of both solar wind but also on solar radiation. So there is, everyone kind of accepts the fact that light does have a degree of momentum. I mean, that's the old equation of H F equals nu. So, you know, it's energy, but it's also momentum. So, you know, there is something to it, but very little. And unfortunately, the M drive will probably be proved as a lab error. But, you know, I mean, if you don't look, you don't find, so that's understandable. I don't take any points off for these guys for getting it wrong, because they at least tried.
Roy, if I do set up a solar sail, do we know the approximate percentage of solar wind thrust versus solar photon thrust that I get out of it? I am guessing the solar wind might be bigger than the solar photon thrust. Over to you, Roy.
Now, the last time I looked it up over a year ago, I think I got the sense that the overwhelming forces were the solar wind, that the solar radiation adds to it, but the most significant factor tends to be the solar wind.
Which I think is equivalent to saying that a photon has nearly zero mass to it. Over to you, Paul.
I know you're talking about force, but if you could ever get the force of the photon up to proper speed, then there would be a big difference, because the solar wind, for instance, takes about roughly 2 days, 48 hours to get from the sun to Earth, where it only takes 8 minutes with photons. Back to you, Dick.
You've got it, Roy.
Well, when we talk about the mass of things, we get into a little semantic problem. The rest mass of photons is zero. Now, they have something that's vaguely called an inertial equivalent because at their speed and the you know, the momentum that they provide, but if you're talking purely rest mass, photons have a zero rest mass, which is the only reason that it can attain the speed of light, and the only speed it can attain is the speed of light.
Is there a simple equation that we could use, Roy, if I know the number of, let me think now, let's call it flux density. Let's call it watts per square meter. If I know the solar intensity in watts per square meter, and if I know the wavelength of the solar intensity I'm looking at, I'm now looking at 500 nanometers, which is around green to the human eye, 500 nanometer wavelength, and the sun gives me 1,300 watts per square meter of total radiation across all of that spectrum. Is there a simple way I can calculate the amount of thrust I get out of just those photons, not the solar wind? There's got to be a simple way we can look that one up. Over to you, Roy, KGRLAW.
I agree that it's probably someplace, and probably tomorrow I will rummage through Google and try and find something along those lines. But as I would think, it's not, once you have the watts of power, you don't really need the frequencies because it's hand in hand. You had that conversation with Steve a couple of weeks ago. A 5 milliwatt blue laser versus a 5 milliwatt red laser. What's the power difference? And there is none. It's because it's 5 milliwatts. As long as it's an accurate statement of the output of the light, that's the power.
If I'm talking about the capability of that power to give heating and damage to human skin, yes, 5 milliwatts of red and 5 milliwatts of green has the same amount of heating capability. But since energy equals E equals H nu, and the amount of photon thrust might be an energy function, and higher frequencies, shorter wavelengths have more energy for the same number of photons, the possibility exists in my mind that I might get more photon thrust, not heating, photon thrust out of a higher frequency. That's a guess. Over to you, Roy, KGRLAW.
I think if they don't have the effect of equal energy density, you're right. If a number of photons, then it's certainly a function of frequency. But as long as you define it as total energy of the light output, it all factors out, I would think.
You might be right. But still, the number of watts that you and I can buy in a handheld laser and the amount of photon thrust that that can give, I think you and I are guessing it's nanonewtons, piconewtons, femtonewtons, attonewtons. It might be an awfully small number, is our guess right now. KGRLAW, you got it right.
It is a very small number, and actually, most likely, we will go around and get right back to this kind of a conversation when I talk about the ISS station's Cold Atom laboratory, which uses laser beams to cool things down, and it has a lot to do with momentum.
Yeah, we all forget that a thermometer is measuring the average kinetic energy of the molecules. If my thermometer is measuring the air in my house, it's measuring the average kinetic energy of those air molecules. That's a fancy way of saying, how fast are they moving? So if I can take a small number of molecules of something, or protons or whatever, and put them into a kind of a chamber, and by aiming laser beams at them, I can make them sit still. If I can stop them from physically moving, that's the equivalent of saying I'm going down toward absolute zero in temperature. At first, that sounds crazy. Many of us forget about the fact that temperature is speed of the particles that you're measuring the temperature of. Over to you, Roy, KGRLAW.
Quite right. And when I first heard about laser cooling, I was a little bit confused because you know, the way that I thought of it, how could you aim a laser at the right atom at the right time? It struck me as a rather difficult engineering feat.
If I've got only a very small number of molecules that I'm trying to control, and I've got a really fast, very accurate servo mechanism that's looking at them by some means it knows where they are, therefore it knows which laser and how much laser power is required to stop that thing from moving. I don't think this is under human control. I suspect this has got to be a very fancy machine that does that work. That's my guess. Over to you, Roy.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Did they get that working? That experiment was just sent up on the Cygnus space craft. They just docked it, and they were going to bring it in, and the astronauts were going to work with it. There's supposed to be a magnetic field involved, and then along with the magnetic field, they were going to use lasers. But I'm thinking this is going to take a long time to get it set up. Are you saying they've already got this thing working?
Well, I was going to explain what they have in mind. I think it's mostly a kind of an assembled construct. I don't know if it just plug it in, turn it on, but I don't think they have to build it from bits and pieces. But, you know, I thought it might be interesting to go through what they actually did, because it's, to me, at least, it's sort of fascinating how you pull something down using things that make sense and things that don't make sense at all. To begin with, strangely enough, before you do anything to these objects, you end up actually heating them up. Usually they're alkali metals. They're sodium, potassium, rubidium, and so they heat them up to something like 700 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, although we're talking about a very, very thin gas of these alkali metals, you have to realize that atoms are very small and there's a lot of them. So even if it's very light and very sparse, we're still talking about millions and millions of either sodium or potassium or rubidium atoms that are gas phase. So if you can imagine pointing a laser, even with the best servo mechanisms imaginable, it would be a heck of a job, right?
Because the number of atoms that you're trying to control in any reasonable experiment you and I can envision is so large, and they're all moving independent of each other and bouncing off each other and whatever, to try to make them all stop. I mean, this is equivalent of having a huge herd of sheep and one sheep herding dog, and the dog is given the order to make sure that every single sheep doesn't move one single foot. They all sit absolutely still, don't wag their tail, don't swing their head back and forth, don't move a single foot. You try to tell a sheep herding dog to make every single sheep in this herd stop moving, that's an impossible task. And that's sort of what we're trying to do here. There's another thing I'm worried about. Let me drop. Whenever I've got something that's hot, it's always continuously giving off radiation by three means. Radiation, conduction, and convection. Okay. By putting it in a vacuum, maybe I can get rid of the convection. But the conduction and the radiation, the walls of the chamber are at some finite temperature. By the T to the fourth function, they are radiating that thermal temperature into the center of the chamber where my particles are. Therefore, my particles are picking up some of the heat of the walls of the chamber. So even if I've got this perfect laser system, I've only got one molecule in there, and I stop it from moving, in a very short period of time, the heat of the chamber walls gets coupled into that particle and starts it moving. Maybe I'm being overly simplistic here. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Well, in a vacuum, you wouldn't really get convection or conduction. You would get radiation. So if you shielded the environment, you would maybe slow down. Eventually, everything always goes back to equilibrium, so you're fighting against time. And all of these setups with very cold temperatures last a very small amount of time, and we'll go into how incredibly small that is. The trick with the lasers is actually what they call the lasers. They don't really call them just lasers. They call them Doppler lasers. And perhaps, Dick, you can guess why they're called Doppler lasers instead of just regular lasers.
Well, under normal conditions, anything that emits a signal and it's moving, if there's a relative motion between the thing that's transmitting and the thing that's receiving, you pick up a Doppler-shifted frequency. If the distance between the two is closing, you receive a higher frequency than is being transmitted, and vice versa. Okay. Lasers are very, very difficult to tune the frequency. Not impossible. The latest issue of one of the electro-optical magazines I get tells you about a kind of a laser that is somewhat tunable in its wavelength.
No, it isn't.
What was that?
Dye laser. It operates in a transverse mode. It has a very broad bandwidth. So, you have to tune it.
Okay. Can I tell it I want it to put out 500 nanometers now, and a minute from now I want it to put out 520 nanometers? Do I have that kind of control, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, if you chose to set up the mechanics and the servo system to do that, you in essence actually can. Essentially, think of a dye laser as you have a medium which is the light amplifier, something that has gain. So some material has to be excited so that the electrons in the orbit of the atoms that is part of the light amplifier are in the higher state. Okay, and when a photon comes along, it's going to release it, and that's how you get the gain. Now, with a dye laser, you're taking actually, I forget the material, it's a liquid, and it runs at a parallel plane to the light amplifier, and it's excited with an argon laser. Okay, and that brings the atoms up to the higher level state. Now, essentially, because you have a cavity, okay, and the light has to travel back and forth, and there's different ways of doing that, using a flat mirrors or concave mirrors. But the tunable aspect of it is, in essence, you're passing that light through a prism. And the prism actually, and you've tuned the mirror, which is the other side of the cavity, as you change the angle of that, you only allow it to resonate at that particular frequency or that particular color. Don't know if I'm being very clear about this, but that's the basic concept.
What's the apparent cue of this dye laser? Is it putting out a laser waveform that's very broadband or very narrow? It would be sure it would be nice if it puts out a very nice narrow beam in wavelength. Let's call it the beam width. No, I'm talking about frequency width, frequency bandwidth. Is it a narrow band emission, like a really high-quality laser, and I can still tune it? I mean, we've got a conflict of interest here. If the Q is high, so that's a very narrow beam wavelength coming out, then I have trouble tuning it. And if I can tune it easily, then it might be broadband. Over to you on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the group.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. As you know, there are different kinds of lasers. The things that make the laser work is the light amplifier. Most things work by absorption, okay? So if we're talking about a gas laser like a Tahini, okay, it's the helium that excites the neon, but the cavity itself, the resonant part of it, the light has to bounce, the photons have to bounce back and forth. It's an oscillator. Okay. The narrower you make the bandpass of the light amplifier, the more frequency selective you get, or
rather, you're selecting the mode, the time that they use, in which you tune the mode actually, okay, let me say that in a straight way. The mode is the frequency at which oscillations are occurring, okay? The places in which it's going to oscillate, of course, is going to be dependent upon the length between the ends of the cavity. So, with the dye laser itself, because the amplifier is so broadband, it almost covers the entire visible spectrum. Let me drop. You are essentially utilizing the prism as a filter, so to speak. Where there's absorption happening, it's not going to oscillate. So, if you've got a mode that's operating at, if we're talking the edge, it's 660 nanometers, okay, based upon the length, the next peak, the next thing that's going to oscillate is going to use a formula. It uses Planck's theorem, and you essentially, if I can pull it out of my head, you are using the curves of the edges of the bandwidth, and because of the length, there are very specific places where it'll oscillate. Depending upon the length, it could be 660, 680, 690. You can work out the mathematics based upon the size of the cavity. So, the narrower you make the amplifier's bandwidth, the narrower the frequency output. Now, you don't want to talk about beamwidth and confuse that with the frequency of the light, because those are two different things. And there's something that's known as the transverse mode, which actually allows it to oscillate at multiple frequencies all at the same time, which you don't want it to do. So, yeah, you can make a device. Let me write it drop again. You can make a device which uses a light amplifier that has a particularly broad bandwidth, and you can select what frequencies of light you want it to create. That would be an optomechanical type of system to be able to do it in the time periods that you're talking about. But if you're on a flat table, on a microflat table for, doing optical stuff on it, you're going to use, mirrors that are isolated from the amplifier, with little tuning screws, and of course, you take that concept and adapt it to something that's automated to do what you want to do. K2IWK3J.
The number of wavelengths of the cavity and the spacing between the two mirrors, so to speak, tells me at what frequency spacing I'm going to get a multiple of 360 degrees of total phase shift of the signal bouncing back and forth. So, in your example, you might have 690, 670, 650, 630, numbers like that. And only some of those numbers are you getting greater than unity gain because of properties of the media. So, I suspect many lasers are, to some degree, a comb generator. That if you had a perfect spectrum analyzer looking at a laser output, you'll see a dominant line, but you might see a couple of other lines at very specific spacings alongside of that dominant line. Is that somewhat true, Eric? K2EJ, K2LAW?
That's precisely true. If you were to draw a... let's say you drew a half a circle, okay, and on the line on the bottom of that half a circle is frequency, going higher in frequency. You will find, and each frequency that's generated, they call that a mode. You will find where the gain of the light amplifier is maximum, which will be at the 90 degree points of the circle, if you've got 180 degrees worth of circle, and the actual gain will be dropping as you go to either side. I'm only using a circle so you can visualize it easily. It's more like a 3dB brick wall filter. Let's just stick with the circle. You'll find that the output levels of the modes under the circle as it comes down to the sides get smaller and smaller.
Yeah, I know that in the case of the gravity wave detectors that we have two of in the United States, the LIGO system. They had to go through heroic techniques to do, first of all, get a line that's very narrow in bandwidth, very high in power output, very high in purity, very low in amplitude modulation, to get a line out of that laser-generating system. They had to do heroic things to control all those modes to make one very simple, dominant, very narrow band main lobe to that spectrum, as I understand it, in order to get proper knowing of the total system. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. You know, on one hand, it's quite easy to do, but with the amount of precision that you're talking about, it's probably very, very difficult. There are a number of ways of ensuring that. In terms of a gas laser, just temperature, the ambient temperature, and how you just blow air on a glass. Helium neon laser, you'll see the whole thing shift in frequency. There are simple tricks, like one of the ways is to prevent any of the transverse energy to come to pass through is you use a device which is an aperture. And you will find a particular point in the aperture where you're, in essence, only amplifying that one frequency because you're absorbing the other photons at the other frequency. And you'll do this with at least one of the mirrors being concave, not necessarily flat. There are other little tricks where you can actually put an aperture within the center of the cavity and do things like that. Another one of the tricks is you'll actually take two concave mirrors, place them at the appropriate point. There will be a segment of it somewhere in the middle. That will be, you know, I think it's twice the wavelength in diameter. And you can then, with the output of that, go through other pieces of optics and actually make the spot smaller and bigger. But the smallest spot that you can possibly make is two times the wavelength.
Now, we're getting a little bit far left of Roy's original question. Do you know of a way that we can take this laser beam that's coming out of the unit and predict what kind of thrust it can create? If I know the watts of laser, if I know the wavelength and the watts of laser power coming out of the thing, are we getting a nano-newtons of thrust? What's your guess on this one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, okay. If you're talking thrust, right, you're, in essence, you're going to be ejecting photons. And the amount of energy coming out is less than the amount of energy that you're using to excite the amplifier medium in the first place. Currently, as I know, and it may have improved because all new different kinds of lasers out there, you're still talking 8%, 10%, 15% efficiency, and that ain't much at this stage of the game. I mean, you can take argon carbon dioxide mixture in a gaseous laser state form, and, you know, you can cut metal with it. You know, what's the action of the photons that's actually cutting the metal? K2RW, K2EJ.
The low efficiency is something I've got to live with. But in theory, if I've got a big enough set of solar cells, and I'm in the I'm in the solar system, so I've got a source of energy. The fact that I'm running at low efficiency may be a red herring. The fact that I can continuously get thrust out of this thing without using up the fuel. See, ordinary rocket engines, you can only fire the engine for a certain length of time and your tank goes empty. The nice thing about a laser thruster is that it has a, as long as I've got a good set of solar cells, or if I've got a good nuclear reactor on board, I've got a kind of tank that doesn't run dry and I can get thrust, a very small amount of thrust, but I can get it for a long period of time. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, we do have megawatt-sized lasers. You've got the energy available, and you have a way to push photons out.
Yeah, but I guarantee the thrust they're getting out of that is not making it break its mounts, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, you know, if you were spitting out whole atoms that have mass, that'd be a different story. Then a lot of Newton stuff will come into play.
Yeah, Roy was about to explain to us why this...